questions being raised with regard to how a person should respond in certain situations. That is to say that sometimes we're in a position where we're told to be independent, not to be gullible. For example, when there's a lot of popular religious ideas today that people are attracted to, and pretty soon everybody accepts them. Like this thing we've been discussing recently, the power of Amen. There's always some new kind of fad trying to energize people to become more religious, and it's based upon a mistaken notion. What they do is, in these cases, something happens and it starts somewhere and somebody feels a certain inspiration. Then they discover certain sources and they misinterpret those sources in accordance with their own emotions. And it makes the rounds until people get tired of it. For example, this thing that getting together and saying amens, every amen that you say has a tremendous force in terms of power, in terms of the universe, and so on and so forth. I really am totally against this in terms of inspiring people with falsehood. That's a separate thing. The way to inspire people to follow Judaism is not, this is really a non-Jewish approach. Because it's falsification. You're not allowed to falsify. You're not allowed to mislead people. If you really create the impression that we have certain charms that really work, and if you do this and if you do that, you're going to have special protections. That's the way you put it. And enable the person to believe that, and because of that, the person makes a certain change. You haven't really helped the person. It's not really free will either. Free will is in terms of your intelligence, your understanding of the truth of the situation. And of course, inevitably, it leads to a disappointment. It's counterproductive. And you're falsifying Judaism. Even if you should be successful in a single case. Everybody would show that you could be successful in a single case. But it's a falsification of Judaism. So, therefore, when a person is confronted with these kinds of things, so they're supposed to be resistant. They're supposed to be resistant. Because there is a pressure to go along, to accept. People pressure you and emotionally try to intimidate you, bully you, and make you feel guilty to question yourself. So it's a good midah to be, I guess, independent, and if you want to use the word stubborn. But then the question goes, we're also told that we shouldn't be a Kshei Orif. Kshei Orif is someone who's stiff-necked, a stiff-necked race. The Jews are criticized for being stiff-necked and for not listening and not being reasonable and rather being stubborn. So the question is being raised, could we differentiate? Obviously, there's no simple solution. There's no simple emotional approach that's going to take you through every case and work. You've got to use your intelligence. So then the question is, how do I know when I'm being resistant, intelligently, and independent-minded, as opposed to when I'm just being stubborn? This is a difficult question to answer, so perhaps we're just going to take some suggestions and see if we can. It's one of those things, I think, that I don't know if there's a simple answer, like you can something that works in every case kind of thing. I mean, a person knows when they're stubborn, when if they have some kind of symptoms of illness and they're refusing to acknowledge it, so the person, that's easy. You know, you just look at the symptoms and don't deny it. In this type of situation, there's many different factors. However, let's start with some of them. None of them is really absolute. A lot has to do with the perfection of the person. A person always starts out with being argumentative. That is, you have certain positions you like, and you seize those positions, and you, when you get into a debate, you're just looking for those arguments that support yourself, and rejecting all the contrary pieces of information, fact, etc. We've all been there. Some people are still there, but we've all been there. And as you mature, you can recognize what you're doing. It's not so difficult. And the more, you see, a lot of things that we talk about, it's not just, how do I know this, how do I know that? And I'll tell you how you know. A lot of it stems from perfection. The more you're honest, the more you're working on yourself, that helps you a great deal. Because if you're striving for greater honesty, truthfulness, willingness to acknowledge when you're wrong, that is a big problem. Every time you're involved in any pursuit, you're being motivated by your ego. Ego is the big motivating factor. I was just discussing this yesterday with my son. Ego, nobody would accomplish anything. The question he had raised, I'll just put it out there, was that in some book he was reading, this person made the point that all successful leaders have tremendous ego. And at the same time, in Judaism, we have Moshe Rabbeinu, and to the contrary, he was chosen precisely because he didn't have ego. So how does that work? So we were discussing the whole issue. It's true, however, that one has to recognize ego. A big problem is that people refuse to recognize ego. People that are combative and they're looking to win, they're looking to satisfy the egotistical emotion, very often they don't even want to acknowledge it, because ego is a very tricky thing. One of the ways in which it tricks you, ego always becomes attached to a cause. That is, all the people with big egos, for example, a person who's running for president or the president, the leaders, you'll see that they're in a bit of a ambivalence. If you ask the person, why are you doing this? Why do you want to be the president? It's very rare that a person will tell you the truth. There's only one reason. We know it's ego. If it wasn't for ego, I doubt that he'd be there. But he will always struggle to find objective reasons of what he wants to do to benefit the country. I'm not saying he's lying. In his own mind, he's convinced that that's what he's doing. If he had total honesty, he would realize that there's many ways you could help the country, and there's got to be a tremendous component of ego to cause a person to assert that he's qualified and to go through everything you have to go through to convince people that they should put the life, the fate of the country in his hands. It takes a tremendous amount of ego. A person who was more philosophical and just had certain good things he wanted to do for the country, he doesn't have to expose himself to all of these challenges and so on and so forth. It's an extremely painful thing, by the way, as well. That's what he meant, that if you don't have a big ego and you're willing to endure all of the hardships that you must go through until you achieve success, because that's the law of life. That's a law of life, that in any area where you want to achieve something, I'm not talking about a simplistic type of phenomenon where there are certain people that aren't geared that way. Everybody is motivated by ego, but the ego expresses itself differently with regard to different people. And it's interesting that whatever it is that the ego is finding gratification in, then there's another, the person will elevate that. This is what really counts in life. So that you have ordinary people who have ordinary jobs, I mean, whatever, nothing that they would really brag about, nothing they would consider a real success. They themselves don't. Plain job, a decent job, whatever the case is, goes to work, but he's not a leader of a corporation. It's not anything that gets you any kind of public recognition. So, very often, these people, what they turn to in life is family. The family becomes extremely important to them in raising them. It doesn't always happen, but there's a pattern over there. Because what's the purpose of my life? What am I accomplishing in life? The person can't really, it's not the kind of job, I would imagine a person is a mailman, and I'm not disparaging anyone, there's nothing wrong with it. I just don't think that a person is a mailman doesn't have that kind of drive. He doesn't, at the end of the day, consider himself to be so successful in what he achieved as a mailman. It would even sound funny if we talked about it that way. And I'm not disparaging. It could be a very intelligent choice, because he doesn't have to put up with the life. Interestingly enough, from a rational standpoint, it looks like a very appealing job.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, you have. I don't think there's that much pressure. Whatever it is, there's nobody. But you're not dealing with a boss.
Great benefits.
And a lot of great benefits. Get a lot of free time also because once you, you know, you have your mail to the, once you delivered, you can take a relax. You don't have to do anything else.
You can learn the rest of the day.
You can learn the rest of the day. And there's a lot of exercise. A lot of these, I find a lot of mailmen are very cheerful. And I, then you'll hear stories about mailmen who, postal work, but that may be because they're stuck in the office, in the post office. Yeah. But I found the ones that make the rounds on the street are very friendly people. All right, I'm not saying it's perfect. Irina's making a good point. Stormy weather. Weather is the end. But yeah, let's, so, even so, it's still worthwhile. Go to California. You think about it, there's many other jobs that are similar. A conductor on a train, and so on and so forth. Now, these people do not have the ego that a person who's struggling, an artist, someone wants to be an actor, or a business person, that wants to be successful and can't adjust to this kind of situation, has to make a name for themselves. We tend to, it's funny, we all can identify with the big ego kind of person, and we tend to sort of look down upon the other person, but if you think about it, who's smarter than who? These people, in my opinion, they do get a certain pride because they have a work ethic. That's not the same as an ego thing. It expresses itself differently. It's a work ethic. I go to work every day. I do my work. And then at the end of the day, by the way, it's much easier for that person to have a sense of satisfaction because he's in complete control of what he's doing as opposed to even a teacher. A teacher, if the kids don't behave, whatever this, you feel bad. You didn't get your job done right. And so on and so forth. So these are factors, by the way. These are factors to consider when you think about what you're going to be going into. Most people don't take into consideration the heartache. So you get a few bucks more, but look at all the heartache you're putting up with.
Yeah, they go home, they go to sleep.
Exactly.
Parents.
Exactly. But I would say, generally speaking, these people also need an outlet. Because the job they're doing really, I don't think it's enough to give them that sense of satisfaction. Very often, these kinds of people, the family, everything revolves around the family life and doing things together. Because then that becomes of a great significance. That's what life is all about. They often will criticize when they read about these other people, these Hollywood actors and successes and those who made it, athletes, all these idols, so to speak. And then, so of course, when you read about that, you sort of feel a little diminished. Everybody does. Because it makes you feel that's the nature of our culture. It's very ego-driven, our culture. So, and we all have that emotion within us. We have to constantly deal with it one way or another. So you read about someone's success and so on and so forth, it makes you feel a little diminished. That's a success. I'm a failure, so to speak. So what they will say is, yeah, but look at their... They love to read about the difficulties they have, the sufferings that their children rebel against them, they don't have a family life, they get divorced, and this and that. And that makes them feel superior. I wouldn't trade what I have for all of the success that this person, all the money in the world, I wouldn't trade a moment of the great joy I have with my family. Of course, the reason he says this is because he never experienced the possibility of getting that money. Whether he would or wouldn't, I don't know, but Chazal say, do not judge your friend until you've been in his place. So, this is really ignorance. I read a fascinating article. Fascinating. There was an article in last week's paper about lottery winners. I think you've heard that from time to time. Someone wins a lottery, and then they do a follow-up. What effect did it have on his life? I'm going to try and make this article available to everyone, because this is not just one case. They studied it about the last 3 or 4 years. And there's a clear pattern of how it not only didn't make them happy, but it messed up their lives. And some of them are completely broke, but that's not even the worst of them. Some of them, a number of them are dead already. People got themselves into crazy kind of situations because you become, for many reasons, it's not easy to become suddenly wealthy. It's very, very difficult because it brings out powerful, powerful emotions. It's different if a person is a businessman and he struggled and he's striving, he has more experience dealing with it, and money is different for him. But someone who's just barely getting by and he's operating with this huge fantasy, and then he comes into this, he has no clue as to what to do and all the negative possibilities. So people are quoting people who've won huge lotteries They're saying, in the end of the day, the whole thing was a curse. I wish it never would have happened. Now, it's hard for the average person to believe this.
I just keep thinking if you're me, it's different. I don't
think it's Everybody thinks if it's me, it's different. The reason why you think that is because at this point in time, you don't have, those emotions have not come to the fore. That's what it means. Don't judge your friend until you've been in his place. That means you judge other people that are involved in sex scandals. How could he do it? It doesn't make any sense. He gives up everything for what? For one moment? For one evening? Whatever. Couldn't he have gone away somewhere and had his tryst and whatever? And we look at these people as being absolutely crazy. Imagining if I was in such a respected position and I had such influence and so on and so forth, I could never do that. If you say that, you really don't know yourself. You're not in his place. To the contrary, he's already gotten used to the glory of being a president or whatever it is. He's gotten used to it. It doesn't have the same meaning for him as it has for you. And to the contrary, it makes him feel like he's entitled, like he's above the law, like he's superior. It brings out the ego. But you don't have that ego at this point in time. Another thing that you can never ever say, I mentioned that last week, that there was some of the great rabbis in the Talmud. There are stories. I don't know that they're meant to be taken literally. Some rabbis would sort of put down sinners, even great rabbis, because in their framework it was very difficult to understand how they could be tempted. And then you have these stories that they were walking by in a river and there was a naked girl and they jumped in and there's a voice from heaven saying, if it wasn't for you, I'd let you drown, you know, that kind of thing, which I don't think is really meant literally. It means that the reason why you're saying that is because you're not in that realm of temptation. So you never know, because were you ever subjected to the same kind of temptation? And for each person, it's different. You may take a look at this person and the girl or the guy, and you can say, I can't see. But you're not there, and it's not your ego on the line. And somebody could come on to you and make you feel so special and different and whatever. And you have the opportunity. You don't know what you're going to do. You'd have a struggle. Hopefully you'd be able to overcome it. But you really don't. You can't predict, because we're talking about free will. So that's a very significant point. Yeah. Most people don't have real, in my opinion, don't have true self-knowledge. The person who feels superior because he has this wonderful family life and criticizes a powerful individual who's very successful but not successful with family, of course he will make family life into a virtue because that's his life. Everybody will make their thing into the virtue. Getting back to our original point, the reason for this digression is because it's vital for a person to have self-knowledge. I keep stressing that time and time again. To be able to observe yourself, even while you're indulging in things, that's an important part of the book of Koheles, Ecclesiastes. That he engaged in certain activities or pleasures, even physical pleasures, and he was observing himself at the same time, to learn about himself. A person has to be honest about himself, and you get to know yourself. And even while you're in the course of doing something, and even when you're reacting, a lot of times when I'll have a certain reaction to something, I'll immediately, as though I was talking about somebody else. It's kind of a schizophrenic in a good way kind of situation. I'm like two people. I'm doing the thing, having, and then the other one I'm criticizing as though it was someone else that did it. Like, that was stupid. Why'd you say that? And, oh, that's what it was. Aha, that was your emotion of such and such. So I'm observing myself. It doesn't mean I'll change. I can keep going. It doesn't, you know, whatever. Well, maybe if I feel that I should apologize, I may do that. But even if I don't feel it's a situation where I have to, I'm learning. I'm learning because I'm watching what I do. And I'm looking at myself no differently than I would look at somebody else. I'm not defending myself at all. And that way I get to know myself. That is a very good quality. Very few people I see have it, because most people do not honestly evaluate what they are doing. They defend themselves. Their honesty, dissection of personality is focused on the other one. They're not fair. I see this all the time. They're completely unfair. they excuse in themselves that which they criticize in others, and it's so blatant to anybody that would watch it. I have a tough time dealing with it. There should be a certain sense of consistency. All right. You know what I'm saying? People, for example, that have weaknesses in certain areas, and they're always constantly dodging any criticism in that area, but it's funny, when they act, then they go and they criticize people for the very same thing that they're always guilty of doing. The lack of any self-knowledge. However, there is a downside to people who are able to really see themselves honestly. There is a downside, in general, that could be associated with a lot of guilt. And you can be very vulnerable. And sometimes it could even go to the other extreme when you... It sounds ironic, but there are people who... Just like there are certain people that are always right and can never admit that they're wrong, there are people who suffer from the other thing. They're always wrong. They're always wrong, and they can never admit that they're right. They have a tough time defending themselves. That is not good either, as the Rambam says, that we can't go to an extreme. That has a lot to do with the question that's being raised. When to be... Sometimes you have to be obstinate, and sometimes you have to be soft and open-minded and so forth. It's very, very difficult. A person has to gain self-knowledge, because I think this is the best way to do it. I mean, Carol has mentioned certain techniques. Yeah, I'll bring them in. But in my opinion, the surest way is, if you really get to know yourself, you will see when you're engaged in defending your position. And there may be times in life when you have to do it. This is so fascinating. There may be times in life when you can't just be honest. You may be in a situation where you're dealing with someone who's trying to get you, a court case, whatever. They're not being fair, and you have to defend your position. And you can't be totally honest with them. And you have to defend your position. But at least, in your own mind, you know the truth. There are many situations, even with your own children, where you can't, you know, where you can't tell them the truth. And what did you do, mommy? And this thing, did you do that? And you can't tell them the truth. It would be harmful. So, but you know that what you're engaging in is not MS. It's not truth at this point in time. You know that you can't allow this other person to win an argument with you, because it'll have harmful effect. So you must win the argument. So therefore you may maneuver, manipulate, and so on and so forth to win the argument or to get something, and it's perfectly legitimate. But at least you're honest in your own mind that really wasn't logically a correct maneuver. A person gets to know themselves. If you develop a habit of honesty within yourself, and you get past that early stage in life, when you're argumentative, when you start out and you're basically argumentative, you believe that you're not. You believe that you're idealistic and you're only searching for the truth. That is a pitfall that people fall into when they're young, there's a lot of rebelliousness when you leave one movement. Let's say you come from a non-religious background and then you become religious. There's many emotions there too. Certain emotions of rebelliousness and so on and so forth. Everybody's subject to this kind of thing. In one of the emails I got, I've been soliciting emails from Noachites to try and explain and describe the difference of practicing, so to speak, Judaism, Noachidism, whatever it is, the Jewish way to God, as opposed to the old way when they were Christians. So it's been very helpful. However, one of the respondents was sort of a caution. I guess she didn't fully understand why I'm interested or what I'm doing, whatever the case is. But she was saying she doesn't think it's a good idea to go around bashing Christianity or tearing down Christianity. Judaism should stand on its own and present its own ideas, and whatever the case, in God's time, or God will have his ways of correcting their mistakes, something to that effect. And she sort of implied that there are Noachites that engage in that, which I can understand in any movement. No matter what it is, any movement, you'll always have people. And people could be attracted at first. What because of certain emotions, and those emotions can lead you to a good place. And then, of course, you have to sort of like transfer from those emotional gratifications to the gratification of the enjoyment of what Torah is, and so on and so forth. A person that, this is a process, that when you first start out in learning and discussions with people, usually you're attracted to a certain position. You're attracted to a certain position, and then you embrace that position. And when you're getting involved in discussions, a lot of it has to do with the victory, with ego, that kind of thing. As you develop and you improve yourself, so you should be able to differentiate between objectivity, to develop a sense of objectivity, and it's painful to be able to listen to the other side and to be able to refute. I mean, if you refute the ideas, to approach things, you can also, in a more logical way, dispassionate. You can feel those emotions. When you're involved in that process of just defending a position because that's the position you're associated with, and you get very nervous when somebody attacks it, a lot of emotions come into the face. You can sort of see when you're in that response. And after the fact, when you're involved in that kind of a discussion, afterwards, you know, talking about the feeling afterwards, you don't feel that great. If you won, you may feel good, but that even that feeling you'll recognize. You may not feel that great about it, you feel you won. So you're not happy because of truth, you're happy because you won the argument. And what I would do in these cases is to review. After the fact, review, and try to to look at the matter objectively. To look at it objectively, maybe discuss it with objective people, and review the reasons that you had. And then you could see whether it's objective or not objective, and make the adjustments. And then you could review the emotions that were affecting you at the time. And that's part of the process. Let's see if we can identify some of the behaviors when you're involved, say, for example, in a discussion, or let's call it an argument. You will see, because when you're in an argument, again, we mentioned you have a certain emotion. There's an emotion that goes along with it. And then there's a certain technique. You're really trying to affect the person. Intimidate, you're piling on. You'll see. If you have confidence in the reasons behind your position, it's a certain, you have a calm approach. And when you don't, you're going to try and frame it in a certain way, even your tone of voice, and to try and intimidate the person as well. You're looking for ways to break the person down. So that's another thing. Are you trying to discuss the issue, or are you trying to break the person down? To the extent that you're trying to break the person down, to that extent, it has to do with the ego. You want to win the argument. If you feel confident about the position and you're really searching for the truth, then why do you want to break the person down? You want to engage in a exchange of ideas. So again, that's another thing which will enable you to detect what you're doing. Am I arguing calmly? Am I calm? There's always that personal innuendo. Don't you see it already? Can't you get it? You know, whenever you're beginning to go beyond the boundary line from legitimate argumentation, I mean, teachers do this, everybody does this, and there's a place for this as well. Because sometimes the teacher has to use a certain amount of the emotional, because very often the student can get out of hand, and a student is just being stubborn and obstinate and not willing to listen. So you have to get them back in line. So there's a time and a place for everything. But assuming where it's really not necessary, and it's just that you don't like the other person, it's another thing you should ask yourself. That's a very good question. When you hear an idea, does the one who is saying it have a lot to do with it. That is, if it's someone that you like, someone who you regard as your friend, you have one kind of reaction, one type of disposition. Doesn't mean you'll necessarily agree with them, but you're favorably disposed. If it's someone that you dislike, then automatically it can't be. You see that in politics today. There's a tremendous amount of this kind of process in the political. It becomes personal. If Bush comes out with a policy, there's a tremendous amount of hatred for Bush, then his enemies, no matter what it is, it's very rare that they can ever give it any kind of credence. So that's another thing that you should be. Who? Are you affected by who said the idea? If this is an idea that comes from someone you don't like, that's it. You can't give it any kind of credibility because you don't like the person. So therefore, already your natural reaction is to break that. That has to be broken down. Because you're dealing with personality. You're dealing with the person behind the idea rather than the idea itself. A good idea, but this is true in many, many cases, is to have a friend. Your objective friend. Everybody should have a friend that they go to for objectivity. Because a lot of times it's not clear to you. These things may not be clear to you. You got into an argument with your husband or with your friend and so on and so forth. And since you're subjectively involved, see, the ability to recognize that you're subjectively involved is very important. And that would be a great thing in a friendship or even in a marriage if you both agree and you have like a third person you can go to and present the case. And this person is not assuming this person is really a helper. This person doesn't have that either emotion, is just looking for the truth, will guide you through that. It's always good to have a objective friend like that. And you can, if you had a discussion and you're not sure if you were just being stubborn or no, it was reasonable. Your reaction was the correct one because the idea that was being presented was absurd. So then you can, that's a very good thing to do, to review your reasoning and with someone that you trust and someone that's going to give you the truth.
Wait, are you saying that if you were going to talk about...
It's interesting. This idea of reviewing one's behavior is a very good idea, provided, again, it doesn't go to extremes. At the end of the day, right, Chet and I one time discussed this in the yeshiva, having a meeting with the guys in terms of improving their midos and behavior. And they were asking about how do you improve. One of the ideas put forward was to kind of review your behaviors. It doesn't have once a day or once every other day. It doesn't really, you know, have to be any set time. Sometimes it could be a number of times because it depends what situations. A person should develop the awareness that he's been through a certain kind of a situation and he should review it. Even if it's not necessarily a day-to-day basis, but on an incident basis. You already should develop the ability to recognize you were in a situation, you got into an argument, or you reacted a certain way. Very often, for example, you will feel intimidated in a store when you're not sure if you're getting the right treatment or if, even with regard to price sometimes, you thought it was for this price, it was advertised. You know, a lot of these things will come up. And a lot of you begin to feel intimidated and you back off. Then you go home and you think about it and you know, you feel bad. Why did I back off? I was entitled to this. You're returning some object. There's always a certain authority that's being thrown at you. So then, that's a situation where you should be stiff-necked. Assuming that you have a legitimate point. A lot of times, see, you have two emotions over there. You have two emotions. A lot of times, obviously, you want this thing resolved. But at the same time, there's the fear, you don't like the confrontation, you just want it to be over. And let's say it wasn't the thing you want, but your husband sent you back. It's his, he's upset, and he's asking you to do it and take care of it and straighten it out. So you're in conflict. You don't want to really do this. At the other hand, you're going to get criticized if you don't do it. So you basically go through the motions, and then you have an answer. You're just looking so you can have an answer. Well, I said that, and they said you can't. They said, no, it's not our part. They can't. You know, that's it. Well, why didn't you say such and such? Well, I couldn't say such and such. Why didn't you just accept it? You could have asked to see the manager. People are intimidated all the time.
Why don't you just go to South?
It's interesting because sometimes, very often people back off. They would now. You got to know when to back off. There are there's a reality out there, and you make your effort. You tried, whatever. Let's say it was an airline. You were bumped, whatever. You know, you go. Why should you don't have to accept this? If you make a case, if you fight forcefully, you may get what you want. But there is a point in time when they're going to explain they can't do this, can't do that, and there is a time where it's a waste of time. Then you see people; they just keep going on and on, aggravating themselves. So neither position is necessarily a good one. However, people tend to back off because of this fear. Guilt, that you're making a fool out of yourself. Guilt, that you're wrong. And this fear of the authority, that this is the authority. Now, in those situations, and generally, you'll see that whenever a person like that does push themselves to make the effort, they usually go to the other extreme. They get angry because they don't feel secure. They don't feel comfortable. That's not even the best tack to take.
There's a book, How to Be Assertive But Not Aggressive.
Yeah, How to Be Assertive in general. Look, sometimes you get angry and make a scene. They may give in to you because they look at you like a crazy person and they just want to like get rid of you. So they'll give in to you. That may work sometimes, but the truth is I don't know if you'll feel that good.
I use that also.
How to be assertive. That is an art.
But it depends on the kind of person, too. You know, sometimes you have to get to the middle road here.
It's a good point. Bear in mind, if you're trying to make a behavioral change, to become more assertive, then you're going to fail. You're going to fail. But don't agonize over the failure. Just keep going. The best policy in life, people that got from anywhere to anywhere, everybody that starts out in any area, in any endeavor, you're going to meet with opposition. I've read some biographies of some of the most successful people in entertainment, people that everybody loved, that great. You can't imagine that. You imagine this person walked out the first day they became a star. Nobody was born a star. And everybody gets doors closed. Now, this is an important point. Many of them will say, just keep going. Because it just keep going. It doesn't matter how bad you were today. Just keep going. Because people defeat themselves. They have such an overreaction to any kind of a disappointment or a letdown that they basically allow their guilt to take over and they quit. They shut down. Excessive guilt, which is not in line with the reality. What you should do is review what you did. You feel bad, it'll wear off, and make some adjustments. And keep going back. And even so, you fail tomorrow. So what? What difference does it make? It doesn't mean a thing. Until you develop the skill. And then you get a certain sense of what works and what's effective. Very often, in being assertive, in certain situations, in being assertive, again, there's not one technique that works in every case. Generally speaking, that sense of calmness and certitude, when you have to understand the other person's emotions.
Yeah.
If you come on like a crazy person, I found, for example, that over the years, being stopped by a cop, everybody that's stopped by a cop tries to have some kind of a technique to talk your way out of the ticket. This is a good one to talk about. My tendency in many situations was to try and be defensive. Or some excuse. That kind of thing. I found that the more you're disputing it, and I guess this has exceptions too, but the more you're disputing it, it's just not true and this and that, whatever it is, and you try, even if you try and do so in a nice, in a reasonable way, or the more you're trying to, well, I'm a rabbi, this, that, you know, that any situation where you're disputing it or you're sort of challenging it in one way or another, more likely you're going to get a bad reaction. Because now you're putting him, he stopped you, and you're saying you didn't do anything, and he's going to be more, you're putting him on the defensive. Or if you're like, I'm so-and-so, and I know this one, I'm that. So then, again, he's not going to like that. You're sort of trying to push him around, so to speak. Whether it's with moral pressure, or whether you know someone, or whatever the thing is, whatever you're going to use to try and get him to not give you the ticket, all those things are pretty much are going to be counterproductive. However, if you're nice and pleasant, and sometimes I've used that one. You're right. I can't imagine why I did it. And you show contrition, then you're not challenging him. He doesn't have to defend himself. You admitted you're wrong. And you show him contrition, and if you ask, you can, you know, like if you say, I really would appreciate it, whatever, if you just gave me another chance, and that kind of thing. If you sort of put yourself at the mercy of the court, it may not always work. But that, I think, is the, generally speaking, the most effective. It's also counterintuitive, because we want, what do you mean? The light wasn't red yet, it was yellow, it was this. Whatever you're going to say to defend yourself, he's not going to accept that. Because if he accepted that, he wouldn't have stopped you in the first place. You're basically saying he's incompetent. Or you're basically saying that you have connections. It's a threat. If you try to use who you are and what you are, even if, you know, you're a rabbi, you're this, you know, you're trying to get somewhere to help other people, it's very rare. It's very rare that sometimes works. It worked for me one time, but not. Maybe I'll tell you the story. That there's an interesting story over here. But that was an exception. As you'll see, I wasn't challenging the... I used to be much more challenging, and I found it very rarely works. However, all the cases where I was very contrite and not fighting him, and you know, you're right, and maybe you could just give me a warning, things like that. You're appealing to the guy as a nice guy, you're not challenging him. That overall, I would say, is the best policy. It's interesting to understand the psychology of the other person. By and large, the cop also feels guilty. He has power, he likes to exercise it, but he doesn't want to be perceived as a bully, as someone that uses it. And he knows that people dislike cops for that reason. Everybody wants to be liked, but he's got a job to do. So given that he doesn't want to feel like he's a bully, if you're implying that he is by challenging him, so then he has to defend himself. On the other hand, if you don't at all, you're acknowledging him. If you admit... So then that's confirming. You're right. You should have stopped. You're doing your job. So then he doesn't feel bad. And then he's more likely to be nice to you because you're confirming him. As a person, you're not a bully. You're a very nice guy. And I'm the crazy person. Oh, so now he could be the good guy by letting you off the hook. I'm not a bully. My job is just to see to it that people don't break the law. You're a good person. You acknowledge it. I'll let you free. That's the psychology of the cop that you have to bear in mind while we're on the subject. Talking about going to a rabbi for a blessing. That's an interesting thing that's very controversial. It's become very controversial.